You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. DC Insane by Bess Levin. Nuking the hurricane, impeaching Donald Trump is a bizarre and strangely familiar nightmare. Opening photo illustration by Michelle Thompson. Chaos Agents. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Trump, Representative Adam Schiff, Hunter Biden, and former Vice President Joe Biden. Throwing a hissy fit when he was told he couldn't buy another country. Declaring himself the chosen one. Flashing a thumbs-up sign while posing for photos with an infant whose parents had just been murdered. Claiming that the sound windmills emit causes cancer. Feuding with John McCain well after the late senator died. Proposing the Department of Homeland Security start nuking hurricanes. Uninviting the President of Mexico from the White House for not financing the wall. Threatening to sic ISIS fighters on Europe. Claiming that Melania and Kim Jong-un had gotten to know each other, despite the fact that they'd never met or spoken. Getting mad at Puerto Rico for not moving the island to avoid another hurricane. Getting mad at Alabama for not being hit by a hurricane. Promoting a conspiracy theory that the Clintons had Jeffrey Epstein killed. Claiming Democrats support the kind of late-term abortions that involve executing babies shortly after they're born. Making aides get a cost estimate for building a wall adjacent trench and filling it with snakes and alligators. Suggesting the Federal Election Commission investigate if Saturday Night Live was colluding with Russia. Every single comment at every single rally he's ever held, 97% of his tweets. Donald Trump has said and done a lot of things over the last 34 months that, were he not President of the United States, would have undoubtedly resulted in a van pulling up outside Trump Tower and a team of orderlies dragging him from his office as he screamed, "Where are you taking me? Who sent you? Fake news, Covfefe," while a weepy Eric shouted, "We love you, Dad," as the elevator door shut. No one expects him to make any sense. Tweets that border on the comprehensible are assumed to be ghostwritten by staff. He denies things that he said in public, on camera. He can't reach the end of a single sentence without a non sequitur about how he would have won the popular election if not for voter fraud, or some incoherent rant about late-night host. Once, he said he invented the phrase prime the pump. He thinks an apostrophe is a hyphen. Conversations about his mental afflictions are openly discussed, though it's clear to most people that it will require decades of intense research by a team of Swiss doctors to even scratch the surface of what is wrong with him. And yet, everything that preceded the multi-week Reactor 4 level meltdown, which will more than likely still be going on by the time you read this, unless they've taken away all the sharp objects, turned out to be but a preview of the batshittery that was to come. Since news broke of a whistleblower's report that he'd pressured the president of Ukraine to investigate Joe and Hunter Biden, tying nearly $400 million in suspended military aid to the ask, all of which was confirmed by the readout of the infamous July 25th phone call released by the White House, Trump has exhibited all the symptoms of someone who was recently bitten by a rabid raccoon one night after getting lost between Marine One and the Oval Office. He suggested that the whistleblowers' sources are spies who should be executed like we used to do in the old days. He's warned of a second civil war if he's impeached. Like a crazed sub-redditor laying out an 80-point post about how the government controls our minds through the fluoride in drinking water, he told followers of a process laid out in the Constitution. As I learn more and more each day, I am coming to the conclusion that what is taking place is not an impeachment, it is a coup intended to take away the power of the people. One day, he screamed about Representative Adam Schiff, who is leading the impeachment charge and jockstraps, while a terrified Finnish president made a mental note to treat every day like a gift if he escaped unharmed. Later, he berated a Reuters reporter for mentioning Ukraine, yelling, "Did you hear me? Did you hear me?" and demanding the guy ask the president of Finland a question, like he was an extra in Goodfellas. He's openly admitted to trying to unmask the whistleblower, and one day sent a tweet that simply read #fakewhistleblower. He wants Nancy Pelosi sued and Schiff tried for treason. He can't go an hour without calling a conversation in which he tried to extort another country for his personal gain, alternatively beautiful, a 10, and most frequently perfect, bringing to mind a dimly lit Soviet-era cell and the words "my perfect phone call" scratched into the wall by someone whose brain unhooked itself from reality some time ago. For all his short-circuiting, though, for all the evidence that the last remaining synapse in his brain, tangled up in ground beef and stolen office supplies, is flashing a warning signal that he's in peril, it's still obvious that Trump believes he's done nothing wrong. We know this because not only is he not trying to cover up his crimes, only panicked White House staffers tried to do that, he's providing investigators with evidence and continuing to openly commit the same crimes that got him here in the first place. Believing it would clear his name, he released a rough transcript of his call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and continues to labor under the assumption that it proves his innocence, despite the fact that it's a less subtle version of O.J. Simpson's "If I Did It." "If I Did It" included Polaroids of Simpson standing over the bodies holding the murder weapon. One day after Democrats launched an official impeachment inquiry, he sat next to Zelensky at the United Nations and told reporters the Ukrainian president must do whatever he can do in terms of corruption, and then laid out all the thoroughly debunked reasons why Biden is corrupt. A week later, he stood on the South Lawn of the White House and told the press that not only should Zelensky investigate the Bidens, but China should too. Driving home that Beijing's efforts would be rewarded in one of those nifty quid pro quo type deals, his call for China to help smear one of his rivals came literal seconds after commenting of trade war negotiations, "I have a lot of options on China, but if they don't do what we want, we have tremendous power." Making it abundantly clear what Trump was getting at, an ally informed Chinese government officials, investigating corruption is an easy way to earn goodwill with Trump. Then there was the night he just came out and said it, tweeting, "As the President of the United States, I have an absolute right, perhaps even a duty, to investigate, or have investigated, corruption, and that would include asking or suggesting other countries to help us out." He believes these things because he's two parts crazy, one part stupid, but also because he's been engaging in corruption his entire life, to the point that it's second nature. It's not so much that he doesn't understand the difference between right and wrong, it's that corruption is his first instinct and the only course of action in his mind. His brain, like a compromised immune system, was defenseless against the infection that is Rudy Giuliani and the bottom-feeding, unsubstantiated conspiracy theories about the Bidens. The other issue is that, having run for office basically as a ratings play, Trump moved into the White House with a toddler's idea of what it actually means to be president, just like he had a toddler's idea of what it meant to be a rich person, gold, everything, and played that out. Of course he was going to use the full weight of the federal government to go after insane rumors about his political rival. That his personal lawyer came across on a 4chan message board. Of course, he thinks, he can ask other governments to investigate his enemies. He will never not think this. He wasn't joking when he asked Russia to meddle in the U.S. election, or when he scoffed at George Stephanopoulos, asking if he'd inform the FBI if another country came to him with dirt on an opponent. One, because he has the sense of humor of a litter box, and two, the part about him being not smart, not sane, and having the morals of Don Jr.'s undercarriage. Likely, he believes it's his right as president to have people killed, if he thought it'd help his chances in Ohio, and will probably tell a fictional story about this at his next rally. They came to me and they said, "Sir, would you like us to take him out?" Next photo, Hear No Evil, Finnish President Sauli Niinistö and Trump at a joint news conference at the White House on October 2nd. What comes next? As the White House made clear in early October, the administration has zero plans to cooperate with the House investigation, instructing key witnesses not to appear for interviews, and calling the whole thing an illegitimate and partisan attempt to overturn the results of the 2016 election. It feels beside the point to note that the White House seems to believe an inquiry is the same thing as being impeached and removed from office, or that the latter would result in Hillary Clinton becoming president. Democrats responded by warning that failure to comply with their request for information will be regarded as further evidence of obstruction, which itself could be the basis for an article of impeachment. But it's clear that Trump and company don't care. While we'd never accuse the Presidential Brain Trust of having a plan, "Jared, you should totally fire James Comey, Dems will love it," Kushner is, after all, advising his father-in-law on the matter. The strategy sure sounds like it boils down to stonewalling Congress and stepping up the rantings, ravings, and deranged gibberish of a man whose title should probably be changed from Commander-in-Chief to Chairman and CEO of the Shithouse Mouse Brigade. One day, he suggested that Big Pharma might be behind the impeachment push. Next month, it'll be the cast of Morning Joe, working together with the New York Times, and Rosie O'Donnell, underwritten by Denmark. I wasn't going to talk about the obstructionist Dems who are trying to illegally seize the White House, he'll tell the crowd at a rally in Florida or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin. They said, "Talk about the best economy ever. Don't talk about Shifty Schiff and Nervous Nancy." How about it, folks? Do you think the kids watching at home should hear about how Schiff paid a migrant caravan to infiltrate the CIA and file a whistleblower complaint against me? Thank you. The Education of Billy Barr by Marie Brenner. Many in Washington wonder why the stiff-spined, fastidious Attorney General is carrying the water for someone as impetuous and morally untethered as Donald Trump. The answer may lie in the lessons William Barr learned from his father, a combative and deliberately provocative New Yorker, not unlike the president himself. Opening photos, Attorney General William Barr, shown here before the Senate Judiciary Committee in May, has staunchly defended his boss and executive power since his February confirmation. And class struggle. After Headmaster Donald Barr left Dalton in 1974, the school yearbook gave him an upbeat send-off. Does a father-son dynamic help explain the strange tenure of Attorney General William Barr? Let's address that issue in a moment. But first, a more immediate question, one that Washington has been asking for the good part of a year. What has gotten into mainstream Republican uber-decent Bill Barr? Many who have known and respected him for decades were baffled when he signed on to head the Justice Department. What was he thinking? One former colleague remarked. Everyone knew what Donald Trump was. Barr didn't need the job. The president, in fact, had already tried to hire Barr as one of his personal lawyers, but Barr demurred, declaring publicly, "I didn't want to stick my head in that meat grinder." And yet, ever since Barr was sworn in last February, some observers have been increasingly bewildered as they've tried to understand Barr's relationship with Donald Trump. The stature and experience that Barr had gained while working for two other presidents, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, as well as his long history in private law practice and public service, should have shielded him from many critics. Indeed, Barr seems to be the one senior Trump official toward whom the president does not project a public attitude of superiority. But there he was in May on a New Yorker cover, shining the president's shoes, alongside Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senator Lindsey Graham, as if he was a willing new recruit to Trump's team of big lie sycophants. Barr's detractors, and even those who have admired him, have been alarmed by his tenacious defense of Trump's views on executive power and wondered about the legal rationale behind a range of policies and pronouncements. Barr essentially dismissed the findings of the two-year-long Mueller investigation. Barr has supported measures that could lead to the indefinite detention of asylum seekers. He has apparently approved administration officials' refusal to comply with congressional subpoenas. And lately, according to the Washington Post, Barr has been meeting with espionage officials from foreign governments seeking their help in a Justice Department inquiry that President Trump hopes will discredit U.S. intelligence agencies' examination of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential contest. A sign that Trump and Barr may be using executive branch powers to augment investigations aimed primarily at the president's adversaries. Amid this convulsion, Barr made headlines in September when it turned out that his Justice Department had downgraded a whistleblower's report, initially keeping it out of the loop that would have allowed Congress to review it. The complaint accused the president of potentially impeachable offenses, including a possible threat to withhold military aid to Ukraine unless the country's leader began an investigation that might dig up dirt on Trump's political opponent, Joe Biden. The whistleblower's account, which was deemed urgent and credible by the intelligence community's Trump-appointed inspector general, alleged that the president had urged his Ukrainian counterpart to coordinate an internal Biden probe with Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and Attorney General William Barr. Barr, for his part, has claimed ignorance about Trump's overture to Ukraine. In May, Barr declared under oath that the president has never asked him to investigate anybody. But despite being prominently named in the complaint, Barr chose not to recuse himself from overseeing the matter. This unprecedented series of events triggered an official impeachment inquiry against the president, only the fourth such probe in U.S. history. In announcing the inquiry, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi stated, "The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law." She also made a point of singling out a brazen William Barr. During a series of interviews, she maintained that he had gone rogue, engaging in nothing short of a cover-up of the cover-up. Meanwhile, a New York Times editorial characterized the administration's stance as deny, deflect, and delay, a playbook that Trump learned from his mentor, the sinister New York fixer and architect of paranoid politics, Roy Cohn. Barr has bristled when his career has been compared with Cohn's, and he was reportedly angered upon learning that Trump had dropped his name with Ukraine's president, and concerned about Giuliani's fixer-like forays as part of the Ukraine affair. Once known for his restraint, Barr surely would have been appalled that the man he now serves was also accusing the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, of treason, using smear tactics reminiscent of Cohn at his most unhinged. Who, then, is the real William Barr? I wanted to investigate that question through the prism of his growing up as a young conservative in the intellectually demanding and socially cosseted world of New York private schools. Ironically, the same schools that educated Cohn. I wanted to understand how he might have been affected in the 1970s by the public scandal that consumed his father, Donald Barr. Then, the headmaster of the Tony Dalton School and a respected voice in academics, on the right-wing opinion pages, and at the center of America's calamitous culture wars. In the photo, Class Struggle, after Headmaster Donald Barr left Dalton in 1974, the school yearbook gave him an upbeat send-off. And there are several photos captioned, "Donald Barr, Headmaster. The whole of Dalton owes a great debt to Donald Barr. The many positive things he did for the school will not be forgotten by the members of the Dalton community, past and present. We are all greatly saddened by his leaving and pay him special tribute with this page." Next photo, School for Scandal. The entrance to Dalton, the elite Manhattan private day school, circa 1979. William Barr's origin story is, in fact, a parable of how family, education, protest, and principle served to shape the era and shape a young man who would become America's chief law enforcement officer. At the same time, it is also a narrative about how a charismatic, domineering, and doctrinaire figure named Donald might have helped define the contours of his son's formative years. Garrick Beck never doubted where his friend and high school classmate Billy Barr stood on the question of executive authority. Barr made his views known soon after he came to Horace Mann, then a rigorous all-boys private school in Riverdale, a leafy suburb in the Bronx. It was 1965, and juniors Barr and Beck, due to alphabetical destiny, were once again seated next to each other, this time in American history class. They were 16 years old, privileged boys of their era, their hair neatly brill-creamed, wearing ties and blazers, combs tucked in their back pockets. In class, they were addressed as Mr. Barr and Mr. Beck. As part of their curriculum, they read To Kill a Mockingbird and the Oxbow Incident. In the second semester, they began a line-by-line analysis of the Constitution, using Your Rugged Constitution as a primer. The book's deep dive into the meaning of the document, Barr would later insist, had a profound effect on him. In future histories of the Trump era, Beck will perhaps become a footnote, the accidental witness who first perceived how fiercely Barr believed in the sweeping powers invested in the commander-in-chief. "I was left-wing, Billy was right-wing," Beck recalled. "Our debates would draw clusters of listeners during lunch." The two teenagers argued at length about the spread of communism, then known as the domino theory. "It was the height of the Vietnam War," Beck remembered. "Billy would say, 'If Vietnam would fall, Indonesia would fall. Hawaii would fall.' He did not lack for patriotism, and neither did I. I would argue that when we were out there supporting dictators, we were also supporting the heroin smugglers and the totalitarians that had divided America." He would say things like, "If you guys get your way, we will be living under the communist flag in no time flat." We sparred constantly, but we respected each other. Turn the lens one way, and they were boys in a time machine of entitlement on a campus of rolling lawns and tennis courts. Turn it another, and they were absorbing the highest ideals of an enlightened education. Barr was the William F. Buckley, Jr. of the class of 1967, a droll outlier who lived in a rambling Riverside Drive apartment with a framed gold Water for President poster in the foyer. Beck, in contrast, was the first Horace Mann student to wear a peace sign button, and when a teacher forced him to remove it, Beck argued that his right to free speech had been violated. At the time, his parents, Julian Beck, and the actor and director Judith Malina ran the experimental Living Theater. They fled to Paris after authorities charged them with tax evasion in an attempt to shut down their provocative off-Broadway performance space. Barr's father, Donald, meanwhile, had been part of a circle of Columbia University conservatives and libertarians. The elder Barr, a moderate Republican, became steadily more conservative as the country was polarized by civil upheaval and the tide of youth movement activists, who began to look upon authority figures with contempt and suspicion. Donald Barr had recently been appointed headmaster of the progressive Dalton School and was already at odds with a few students and parents, who considered him a reactionary who ruled the corridors and classrooms like his own personal fiefdom. Donald Barr was a school headmaster from 1964 to 1986. He died in 2004. I found Garrick Beck at his house in Santa Fe more than 50 years after he graduated from Horace Mann. As teenagers, he said, he and his friend Billy debated a subject that has become a touchstone in American politics today. What are the parameters of presidential authority as defined by the founders? Beck had a granular recall of those discussions. What we believed innately was already showing through. We argued about the Constitution as it was reflected in President Lyndon Johnson's treatment of the war. I argued that Johnson did not have the constitutional authority to enact this war. Billy said, "All the president needs to declare war is an executive order. That is all." I said, "Nonsense. The president needs a declaration of war from Congress." I really believe that Billy saw the Constitution as concentrating power in the chairs of the committees and in the cabinet secretaries, the Supreme Court, and the president. Beck and his classmates never doubted Barr's decency. He never cheated on an exam, Beck insisted. He never belittled homosexuals. He never smoked pot behind the gym. When Beck got into trouble for wearing that peace button to class, Barr brought him a gift, a button with a jet bomber depicted inside a peace sign. The caption, "Drop it." "I took it as wit between friends," Beck said. "Billy's humor was always there." In the 1967 Horace Mann yearbook, Barr had already been tagged with his future persona, a staunch conservative on political issues, a master of facial contortions, and a brilliant mimic of his Catholic school priest. Often he rode the subway home with another classmate, Barry Sheck, who would become an attorney and eventually co-found the Innocence Project, using DNA evidence to free wrongly convicted prisoners. We would argue all the way down from school and all the way back, Sheck said. Next photo, on the march. Women's rights activist Betty Friedan at a New York City demonstration, 1970. Barr and his three brothers revered their father, spending countless hours at the dinner table discussing philosophy and politics. Before attending Horace Mann, all four siblings had gone to Corpus Christi, a nearby parochial school where he was in class with many Irish, Hispanic, and black students. William Barr was the privileged son of an intellectual. In first grade, he made a speech in class supporting Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower for president. At age 8, Barr told his parents that he wanted to learn to play the bagpipes. His father not only encouraged him, but located a former Scottish pipes major in the British Army and for years personally escorted his son up to 168th Street for Tuesday night classes. At one point, the young Barr even declared to his Horace Mann advisor that when he grew up, he wanted to become head of the CIA. Horace Mann was another environment entirely, completely secular, with a large Jewish contingent. A few who knew the Barr boys came to call them the Bully Barrs. The siblings, these former classmates claimed, could be intimidating. The fact that his father was born Jewish was not a factor in Bill Barr's upbringing. While he knew he had Jewish relatives, he never discussed the specifics with his father. He had become more Catholic than the Catholics, he said to those who asked. The school was an enclave of conservative privilege that had educated New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, historian Robert A. Caro, and Cy Newhouse Jr., the late owner of Condé Nast, the parent company of Vanity Fair. The head of the history department, Alfred Briggs, lectured on the evils of communism and Red China and lavished praise on Horace Mann's most notorious graduate, Roy Cohn. "We need more Roy Cohns in the world," Briggs frequently said. "Roy was my best student of all time." 60s conservatism was often under fire from establishment Republicans on the right and the nascent counterculture on the left. And, as it turned out, the class of 67, my own class as well, would be the last to graduate in the shadow of World War II's silent generation. During Barr's final semester, Johnson ramped up the draft. Muhammad Ali refused military service. Aretha Franklin released respect. And Israel won the Six-Day War. As school let out, San Francisco was enveloped by the summer of love. In the face of all this turbulence, Barr went off to Columbia, which erupted his freshman year. The campus strikes and shutdowns, he would later admit, were absolutely crucial in focusing his priorities. When student protest shuttered college buildings, he used the word anarchic to describe the face-off, furious that the demonstrators, with whom he tangled at the time, were interfering with his ability to enter the library for his classwork in Chinese studies. Soon after graduation, Barr joined the CIA as a China analyst while attending George Washington Law at night and married Christine Moynihan, a librarian. They would raise three daughters, all of whom would become attorneys. A devoted family man, Barr would take a leave from work when his youngest daughter, Meg, had a recurrence of lymphoma, staying with her for months as she was isolated after a stem cell transplant. "Meg's illness changed our family," he told journalist Judith Miller, "and it changed me." Next photo, Biden time. William Barr at his 1991 nomination hearing with Senators Joseph Biden and Patrick Leahy. Fast forward to 2019. Today, Beck and other classmates are mystified that Barr has appeared to bend time and again, not to some clear-cut legal principle, but to the will of Donald Trump. "I think it is an American tragedy," Beck said. "You start off on one road in life, and you go further and further from where you were, and you lose yourself." Others contend that Barr has ample precedent, operating in the style of a long line of attorneys general, Robert Kennedy, John Mitchell, Alberto Gonzalez, and Eric Holder, who were accused of acting as the president's de facto defender. According to James Zirin, the legal commentator and former federal prosecutor, Barr is from the school of l'état, c'est moi, I am the state. A man, in the end, not unlike his father, Donald Barr. Last May, Susan Semile was at her country house in Hudson, New York, when she heard a familiar voice drift up the stairs. Decades earlier, Semile, a Dalton School graduate, had been hired by Donald Barr to teach social studies and remained for 25 years. She is now a professor at City College. The sound coming from the Senate hearings pulled her toward the TV. It was a voice that she had lived with for a generation. "The tone of overknowing moral superiority, that is what I heard," she said. She came downstairs to see William Barr, as rumpled and stern as his father had once been, with the same granite expression that had vexed her during her early teaching career. "You seem to have been the designated fall guy," Senator Richard Blumenthal, the Connecticut Democrat, said to Barr. "History will judge you harshly." His face remained impervious. His reaction and his voice were so similar it was eerie, Semile remembered. "I immediately thought, this is Donald Barr. He has the same glasses. He was trying to turn the clock back in time, just like his father once did. He was the Danish King Canute, trying to hold back the waves." "The same tone, the way he moved," Semile went on, pondering the impact of the Attorney General's relationship with two father figures. "Donald Barr and Donald Trump, the same chaotic style of management and rule by UCASE. I thought immediately, this man cares deeply about his place in history. Billy has a score to settle." That day, Dalton graduates began to message one another through their Facebook pages. "Can you effing believe this? Are we back in high school?" For some in this group of professionals in their 60s, long removed from the terrors of high school, Barr's appearance triggered curiously primal memories. At home in Pomona, New York, the filmmaker Jonathan Sloan was listening to New York Public Radio's Brian Lehrer show when the host asked a guest, "Who is William Barr?" "I threw a book at the radio," Sloan told me. In London, the psychologist Anne Plachette Murphy, a Dalton grad, tuned in. "The apple does not always fall far from the tree. Barr could have gone through life in opposition to his father, but you could not have watched him at the Senate and not thought, this is Donald Barr." In Brooklyn, book editor Sarah Crichton said she went into spasms when she saw Barr testify, remembering the moment the headmaster called an assembly and decried the women students who were seeking permission to wear slacks to class. The rule was that you could not wear pants unless it was below 20 degrees outside, she said. Mr. Barr stood up and told the assembled high school, "Your desire to wear slacks is masturbatory ego gratification." Dalton, a tall, narrow, red brick building, situated then, as now, at the corner of Park Avenue and 89th Street, had always attracted the sons and daughters of artists in the elite professional class, drawn to its unusual style of education that is focused on creativity. As Bill Barr started his sophomore year at Horace Mann High School in 1964, his father was hired to up the standards at Dalton, a school started in 1919 by the experimental educator Helen Parkhurst. Among her innovations, no bells to signal class changes, individual labs set to the student's own pace. Barr was brought in to put Dalton on the map, Samil recalled. Many people thought he was a genius and a madman. The school was going nowhere. Barr was installed to give it a mandate. Plachette Murphy explained, the values in the 1960s were not about money. They were trying to educate the next Jackson Pollocks. Dalton parent Jacob Javits, at the time a Republican senator from New York, came to Samil's fifth grade class to talk about his experience growing up. So did Dalton parent Norman Potteritz, editor of the left-leaning commentary magazine, who by the 1970s would transform into a leading neocon. How better to teach 10-year-olds than to have them hear how the best and the brightest had learned to use cutlery at Shrafts? The student body would be made up of the children of Saul Bellow, Bob Fosse, Neil Simon, Robert Redford, Elia Kazan, Richard Avedon, as well as Rockefellers, Whitneys, and heads of television networks, and Lincoln Center. The actors Wallace Shawn, Tracy Ellis Ross, and Claire Danes attended too. So did comedian Chevy Chase and author Francis Fitzgerald. In 1979, Woody Allen, whose son Moses Farrow was a student, used the exterior of Dalton to film the scene from Manhattan, in which Isaac, played by the 42-year-old Allen, tries to seduce the 17-year-old Tracy, played by Mariel Hemingway. Next photo, odd couple, President Trump and his attorney general at a White House news conference in July. I heard the name Donald Barr for the first time in 1972. New to New York, I worked as an assistant in the story department of Paramount. My boss, an ardent feminist, was a Dalton mother and sympathetic to an effort by parents to force Barr out of his job. In 1971, New York Magazine had run a story, The Parents' Revolt at Dalton, and it opened with an account of a Dalton PTA meeting at which an insurance executive gets punched. An accompanying cartoon showed Barr using a large contraption to eject unruly students. At issue was his high-handed tactics and the school's power struggles against the backdrop of an America imploding over the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, and the policies of Richard Nixon. Anyone caught smoking pot, even off campus, was ousted. He was one of the people standing in the way of a cultural tidal wave he did not understand, recalled a Dalton student from that era, Mark Edelman, now a professor of anthropology at Hunter College. The uproar was my first exposure to the hysteria that can overcome private school parents. It represented a new language for me, having come from a public high school in San Antonio, where the rules were more or less the same as those Barr was trying to impose. The language of the cave dwellers intrigued me, the Horace Mann versus Dalton differences, and seemed as remote as the caste brandings of the Brahmins of Varanasi. The ability to say, I am a Dalton parent, had a special cachet in the 1970s, implying that you were part of a strata of infinite varieties, as New York phrased it, a member of the media elite and our crowd, Jewish society, with a few social register WASP, downtown lefties, and Columbia intellectuals thrown into the mix. These parents were determined to have a major say in how their children's school was run. By accident, I had stumbled upon a rarefied war that had pitted a headstrong headmaster against the parents and students of Dalton, who were attempting to react to the cultural revolution that had upended the country. Barr's dress codes, Popinjay snobberies, and Eisenhower-era dictates had the place up in arms. Blue jeans are for the working class, he told a group of students who wanted to wear them with their blazers. We are elites, and we do not train anyone here to be working class." At first, Barr had seemed an enlightened choice. The son of an economist and psychologist, he had attended New York's progressive Lincoln School in the 1930s, and in the style of the era was a Marxist, then a fierce anti-communist after World War II. Lincoln was a Valhalla of intellect, where John D. Rockefeller, Jr. sent his own children to learn with the new John Dewey principles, which were geared toward each child's own strengths. During the war, Barr joined the OSS, forerunner to the CIA, and later taught English at Columbia, was an associate dean in the engineering school, and ran a weekend program for gifted high school science students. Barr, never shy about his accomplishments, would boast that he had published reviews of 250 books, principally for the New York Times Book Review. When asked about his religion, he said he was an atheist and insisted that he be addressed as Dr. Barr, although according to the Times, he had never completed his Ph.D. His wife, Mary, an observant Catholic, had a degree from Yale, taught at Columbia, and was an editor at Redbook. Barr was an innovator. He believed that the best teachers did not come out of teachers' colleges and thought that the Columbia Education Building should be blown up, Samil recalled. Another former student noted, "I mentioned to him once that I wanted to learn Japanese. The next week, there was a Japanese tutor." The school at one time offered 14 languages, and despite being a disciplinarian, he generally welcomed a variety of perspectives. "My father was pretty strong on encouraging opposing viewpoints," William Barr would later confide to a co-worker, "as long as they were peacefully expressed and not impinging on others." Donald Barr was a guest on the popular David Susskind show and was profiled in the New York Times Magazine. In the 60s, while New York private schools still had implicit Jewish quotas, Dalton, largely Jewish, was decidedly inclusive. "There were students of color and student with disabilities," Samil said. In the press, Barr crowed that Dalton students had pizzazz. In short order, the headmaster managed to double Dalton's enrollment and, according to the Times, made it among the most desirable schools in the city, rebranding an institution that, despite its stellar history, had been fading in allure. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection from Vienna Gold, Waltzes, Marches, and Polkas, a tribute to Johann Strauss, the London Festival Orchestra conducted by Eric Rogers.